All right. You're good, right?
Good. I'm good.
You know the drill. You've been through this a million times. So right at the outset, I have to say that this is one that I've been wanting to do for some time now. When I think of those special things about the trajectory of the music of Bruce Springsteen, beginning with those early songs, you know, the promise of youth, you know, the promise of Friday night, the promise of Saturday night, you know, like we hear a lot on the River album, the promise of the dream, the promise of whatever it is that you're chasing, those connections that we make, the ones we cherish and the ones we long for. Somewhere at the heart of the Set Lusting Bruce podcast, these sentiments are contained again and again and again and again. And those of us who have had the good fortune of sharing a conversation with Jesse Jackson on the Set Lusting Bruce podcast know the value of these connections as we've experienced them both alone and collectively through our best times, through our darkest times, and we've had the honor of sharing them on Jesse's platform. It's been an honor to be able to return the hospitality where Jesse gets to sit back and answer the questions for a change, and I'll be in the driver's seat this time, whether he likes it or not. Jesse is the host of the Set Lusting Bruce podcast, as well as a podcast on Doctor Who, which we can talk about if he likes, to give our listeners an eye-opening example of the commitment and dedication Jesse has to his work. Set Lusting is now approaching its 1,000th episode. Jesse Jackson, welcome to the Rock Under Fire podcast. I rarely do an introduction, but as a podcaster, I am in awe of the energy you put into what you do. What is the secret? What are you doing that I'm not?
Yeah, thank you so much for joining me, for having me on. I really appreciate it. Those are very kind words. You reminded
me. You're joining me, buddy.
Yeah, I know. I can't see. I'm so used to being in the mode. Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Mike was with me last June, and we had a great conversation. It was right after the locker notes had just been released, and we talked a little bit of writing. To answer your question, I love talking to people, Mike. I way back in 2015, I had been podcasting with about Doctor Who and Farscape and Castle and other TV shows, and I really decided that I wanted to talk, to do more of an interview podcast. And at the time, there was no one talking to Bruce Springsteen fans. And two things happened. One, Lynette Carolla, who was at the time married to Adam Carolla, did a few episodes where she interviewed celebrity friends of hers talking about their Springsteen fandom. And I loved hearing, you know, people talking just like another fan. And then Springsteen and I, that film came out, which was all fans talking about what Bruce's music meant to them. So in the spirit of lighting a candle instead of cursing the darkness, I started the show. One of my favorite stories is at the time I was part of a network, and Rob Southgate owned the network, and I was talking to him. I said, hey, I want to do a Springsteen podcast. And he says, okay, if you're passionate about it, we'll go for it. And he hung up the phone. He looked at his wife and he said, Jesse's going to do a Springsteen podcast. I think it'll last the season, which is 12 episodes.
Yes. And I remember you telling me that.
Yeah. So now then, you know, I am about to hit 1,000 episodes. And it doesn't matter. I'm tired some nights. I'm like, oh, I just want to sit here and veg. But the moment that Zoom comes on, as soon as that phone call happens, you know, I'm just engaged, and I love talking to my guest.
It's almost a rush, isn't it?
It really
if you
is.
See that thing pop up. Jesse Jackson has entered the chat room or whatever yeah. it says, you know?
And, you know, what's amazing, Mike, in an interview show is there are, I always have fun and I always enjoy it, but there is a time where you get lightning in a bottle, where someone shares something so inspiring or personal that you connect. You know, I've done this a couple of times where it, I specifically bring up Skip Sherman is the co-host of the Skip and Sherman podcast, right? And we spent 3 hours talking to each other. And we kept just at the end, like, oh, maybe this, maybe this. And we finally ended up like, okay, we've got to stop. And so, you know, I just, and one of the things that I love about your podcast is you talk about we're overhearing a conversation. And when Set Lusting Bruce works best is it sounds like you're in queue to join a Springsteen concert and you're overhearing the people in front of you having a story and exchanging, you know, ideas and talking to each other and you feel like you're eavesdropping.
Yeah. And that wasn't really like the intention initially here because I started with two co-hosts.
Right.
And they gradually both dropped off and I stopped doing less introductions and just having conversations with people where, you know, I was contacting people either by phone or through Zoom. So we were no longer sitting at the same table around a mixer and microphones. So there was no real start. We were just having a conversation and I hit record at some point. And wherever I hit record, that's where the podcast starts. So it kind of happened by accident, but I was like, you know what, I'm not the only one that does that. Obviously, like a lot of people do that. I mean, I think Marc Maron is maybe the go-to guy when you think about that format. You know?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I want to talk Springsteen tonight. I want to get into the tour a little bit. But also, I feel compelled to take your approach tonight at the outset and talk a little bit about yourself, or if you just want to get into how you came to Bruce or how Bruce came to you, whatever happened first in terms of, you know, your fandom, when did it start? How did it start?
So in 1980, Mike, I was dating a wonderful woman named Linda. She ended up, and by the way, there is a Springsteen song, Linda, Let Me Be the One, in tracks. And she did Let Me Be the One. And we had been married since 1984. But in 1980, we were dating and she had a really good friend named Lisa. And Lisa had gone to school on the East Coast. And she came back and was just raving about this guy named Bruce Springsteen. She was just on and on and on. And I had never heard of him. And then I heard Hungry Heart on the radio. And so I picked up The River and, you know, I liked it. Then Born in the USA came out. I skipped Nebraska totally. Like everyone in America, you know, I was born in 59. So right, Mike, I'm in my middle 20s. Everyone in America is buying Born in the USA and, you know, we're in love with Bruce. And then I bought Tunnel of Love and I bought the live box. And if someone had asked, I would have said, oh yeah, Bruce Springsteen's one of my favorite musicians. But I was really obsessed with Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys. I just adored their music. I bought every book I could find. I bought every album, every, you know, whatever I could find. And so Bruce kind of drifted away. And I discovered, you know, John Hyatt and, you know, we were living in Dallas. And so there's Brave Combo and Sarah Hickman and Edie Brookhave and the New Bohemians. And so we're learning all this new music that's coming out of Dallas. And I always in the back of my mind said, I wish I could have seen Bruce perform live. And when the reunion tour happened, there was a conflict. I couldn't go. So when the Rising happened, two things specifically happened. One, after the towers fell, a week or two later, they had a fundraiser on TV. All the networks covered it, and it opened with Bruce Springsteen.
Rise up, rise up.
My City of Ruins, right?
Yeah.
And I was blown away by that song.
You and me both.
I mean, that is such a iconic moment. And then in February 2002, I went to my first show. And it was on the Rising Tour. I had bought the Rising, but I hadn't studied it. And so the story I tell, Mike, is I felt like I had gone into a really great movie like halfway through it. Like I could tell this was genius. I could tell this was amazing, but I'm missing something. I'm missing something. And so when Devils and Dust came out, I listened to that on repeat constantly. And then when he came to Dallas, I went to that show. And that's when seeing him live and becoming a passionate or obsessed with that is where it happened. And then I started going to more shows, and then you realize, hey, I can travel to go see a show. I don't have to wait for him to come to Dallas. I can drive to Nashville, or I can drive to, you know, somewhere else. And so I'm at 19 shows and counting, and I was a huge fan. And then in 2015, when I started the podcast, has just increased my passion and my community. I think the Springsteen fandom overall is a really good fandom. They're a healthy fandom. We've got a little bit of issues right now because of all the tickets, and I'll be glad to talk about that. But overall, Springsteen has a line in Land of Hope and Dreams where he says, you'll need a good companion for this part of the ride. And that works in two ways. One, I'm a Doctor Who fan, so his partner is called a companion. And so I feel like Bruce and his music has been a good companion for me on my life.
I remember hearing that line for the first time and thinking, how long is this ride going to last?
Yeah. You know,
and we talked about the last time we spoke, when did you ever imagine that year, that tour would be the halfway point?
Yeah.
All that. And we had no idea. Nobody did. Bruce didn't, of what was still to come in the next 20 plus years. Really quick before we get to the tour, just out of curiosity, did you ever get to the heart of what wasn't fully working for you on the Rising album? Did you ever figure out like what it was about that record that didn't completely click with you? Because I had the same experience, and I'm wondering if it's mine is the same as yours, or if, like I said, if you ever really thought that deeply about it where you were able to cut to the heart of it.
So what I think was, the Rising was, I had not developed the muscles of treating a Springsteen album as almost an assignment. I was still at the point where you get a CD, you plug it in, and you kind of listen to it, and you know, oh, that was fun. Versus now, then, when whether it's Letter to You or Only the Strong, you put that and it stays and repeat. It just stays and repeats. You're doing it. So the Rising is now one of my favorite albums. There's three or four songs that I can skip. I am not a purist that says every Springsteen album is, you know, gold from, you know, platinum perfect from, you know, track one to the last track. But there are just some of the tracks in the Rising that I love. So I think that was it. I wasn't kind of diving into that full experience. And so I think that's why.
Yeah, I would agree. I think initially with me was that it was too long. I think there were a few songs that could have been trimmed.
I agree. Yes.
I won't mention what they are, I guess, but you know, it was just a little bit too much. I think he could have stopped at like 11 or 12 songs.
One of my favorite comments that I hear from people is that, like, you know, let's say, you know, hey, The River would have been stronger if it was a single album, but I don't think people can agree which songs you leave off, right? So I think the same thing, like there are songs in The Rising that you might go, he could have dropped that, while I might go, oh, that's absolutely necessary. And you know, that's the part where you're trying to second guess the artist.
Yeah, and I think we talked when we were talking about the River the first time, and I won't spend too much time at all on this, but the single album that we initially were going to get, that we know as The Ties That Bind, out of 1979, would not have worked, does not work. But trying to cut The River as we know it into a single album would be excruciating.
It really would.
It would be painful, like trying to pick between your kids, you know? And it's I know that, again, Bruce has been crucified over the decades for what he left off up until the tracks, not the tracks. Yeah, up until tracks.
Yeah.
Then again, when he released the River Box. But, you know, that's another conversation. I do want to talk about the tour. Let's see. There are a few directions we could go here. Going into the tour, coming out of the ticket sales late last summer, obviously the elephant in the room was the price of the tickets. Now, as far back as the River tour, there's always been some sort of ticket controversy surrounding Springsteen shows. The only thing new this time was the astronomical prices. How different was this ticket experience for fans from how it was with the Broadway run? Is it much different? Are they doing something any different concerning the, you know, the dynamic ticket pricing? I don't know too much about that.
Yeah. So this is the dynamic pricing is something that Ticketmaster has put in, and supposedly, and I use air quotes, to try to get more money to the artist versus to scalpers. And so in a simple terms, and I'm sure someone listening to this is going to tell me I'm totally wrong, but let's say a ticket is $100 just for the sake of simplicity. If a scalper buys it and demand is high, he can get $500, $1,000, $2,000 for it. Then the artist doesn't make any extra money. So Ticketmaster has dynamic pricing that if there is a big demand for a show, much like Uber surge pricing, the price for the ticket goes up. Now, a couple things that I think is unfair is when you and I, let's say you and I go out to eat, and it's a crazy time and we go to get an Uber and it says high demand, you're paying four times the going rate. You and I can either decide to pay that, or we're like, hey, let's go get another drink and let's try again in 30, 45 minutes, right? Ticketmaster doesn't tell you we're paying five times the price. It just says, oh, now the price. I have heard stories from people that I believe that they put the ticket in their basket at $500, and then when they went to check out, it was $1,000. So they're really unhappy. My thought, then John Landau, through Bruce Springsteen, makes a lot of money. Bruce Springsteen makes Sony a lot of money. I do not understand how they have not hired the best public relations people in the world to handle things like this, but they don't. John Landau says, hey, you know, overall tickets did pretty good. We're okay. And Bruce is like, hey, in the past, I told him to go under market. This time at our age, we decided to go market. And so therefore, a lot of fans feel disillusioned. They feel like this guy's one of us, and now then he's putting this shaft to us. I've been talking, so if you want to say something, please.
No, I'm agreeing. I'm just kind of smiling because I'm agreeing, and yeah. It's, you know, it's I'm smiling because when they had a chance, both Landau and Springsteen, they had a chance to do some damage control. And by not having that PR person in place and taking matters, I don't want to say taking matters into their own hands, because they should have, we should have heard from them.
Absolutely.
But instead, it turned into a public relations disaster.
Absolutely.
On their parts. And I think what it did is it just further infuriated people. Of the people you've talked to, how has it been an overwhelming number of fans who are passing on this tour? Is it just mostly just casual fans who are passing?
No, I think that, in fact, I think casual fans are going more. This is my opinion only. This is, like if this was a news station, we would have my signature at the bottom. This is a Jessitorial. I got three tickets for Dallas, all under $200 each. They were in upper levels. I got three tickets for Tulsa, upper level, all under $200. I paid extra because I got them the day they went on sale. If I had waited, Tulsa was going as cheap as $40. You could have gotten in the door for $40 in Tulsa. Houston, a buddy of mine reached out and said, I have access to a suite. Do you and Linda want to go? And it was on Valentine's Day, so we decided to take the plunge, spend way too much money, but we were in a suite with another couple. We had, you know, we had all the food and drink we could eat. I mean, it was a really fun experience. And then I didn't have a ticket to Austin, and I was going to go down and try to get one, and someone reached out to me and said, I have an extra ticket. Do you want to go? And so I went. The overall feedback I've gotten from people that have talked to me, both listeners and guests, is that tickets are available and they are reasonably priced unless you want to be in the pit. And then depending on if it's an East Coast show, on the, an East Coast show, and you're wanting to be in the pit, you are going to pay a high price. Right. I heard people complaining that Tampa prices were ridiculous. They had to pay $1,000 each. And I said, okay, let's think for a minute. Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band have not toured in 7 years. That is the opening night of a tour. How many people want to be at that opening night? Supply and demand, it's going to be expensive.
Right.
So I had people come back to me, well, like, I'm not going to pay a fortune to sit in the bleachers. Then don't. But you can't say that in the narrative, and I'm very unhappy about this. Like, the New York Post had a story that I just saw. You have to pay the cost of a mortgage to go see E Street, go see the band. You don't, unless you want to be, and they'll go, well, I don't want to pay $200 to sit behind the stage. Okay. Then don't. Yeah. But I will tell you, in Austin, I was behind the stage. I think it's one of the best seats because they have the screens and you can see the whole audience and the band comes behind you and waves at you.
The point is to get in the building. I don't care where I sit. I've been behind the stage and I've had just as good a time as I've, you know, I'm not going in any pit. I'm on the East Coast, right? Yeah. I don't care where I'm going to be, you know?
And so that's what frustrates me, is that they are saying and they want to go back to, well, he should make it easier. he should do something. And I'm like, okay, what's he going to do? And well, and I'll talk to you this as long as you want to, but I think the bottom line is that people are not going to be happy unless they get to go to the shows they want in the section they want at the price they want to pay. And yeah, that's just unrealistic.
This is not the 80s and the 90s anymore.
No. And, you know, I did have a great moment, right? Pink is coming to the DFW area. She's going to play at the baseball park here. And my wife really wants to go see Pink. And I go, yeah, that'll be fine. So I go, hey, what do you want to spend? What did we spend for Bruce? Well played. Well played. I will make sure we have good tickets.
That's awesome. Strategic.
Yes, very strategic. You know, it is, I remember dating where you paid, it was $250 to go to a movie in the 70s. Now then you pay $20 to go see a movie. Everything's more expensive. And I do agree that Bruce did this poorly. Someone brought up, you know, they had to postpone three shows recently as we're recording this, all because of illness. They didn't say who was sick. That left a speculation. When he showed up at Philly, he didn't acknowledge that they had missed three shows. There was a lot of speculation that perhaps, you know, was it Bruce who had COVID?
Was it Bruce? Yeah.
Yeah. And because I was there in Dallas when he said, little Steven, COVID, Susie, COVID. You know, I was there in Houston where Niels wasn't there because he had, you know, COVID. And in Austin, Jake was out. You know, why wouldn't they just share? Was it that? I speculated that, was it Bruce's mother? Because, you know, she is older.
I caught that. Yeah, I saw, yeah. I read that and I was thinking like, yeah, that's, I think you may have been the only person I've seen even raise that possibility.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, she is very older. That would explain why Patty's not been at the shows. So we don't know. And therefore, that leads to speculation. Once again, I believe that Bruce Springsteen, Landau, Barbara Carr, Sony Music can afford a really good PR person to say, okay, here's how you address this. This is the best way to do that. Will it make everyone happy? No, but at least you're doing your best to try to communicate.
Yeah. I think regarding the fans that say, well, Bruce should do something, there's a few things to consider. One, you know, nobody has stood up to Ticketmaster. Nobody is standing up to Ticketmaster. I mean, Live Nation, which pretty much owns Ticketmaster, they control all the major venues, all of the promoters. They have, you know, it's a monopoly pretty much. Yeah. Without even getting into their MO before this dynamic pricing, where this, you know, the scalpers used to be the primary problem at Springsteen concerts, but those scalpers were out in the parking lots. You know what right. I mean? Those tickets were already paid for. And I mean, I admit I bought a lot of tickets in the parking lot, but Ticketmaster has become the scalper. You know, prior to this dynamic pricing, this is nothing new with Ticketmaster. I've heard, and I'm not going to call percentages, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say maybe 10% of those venues are being made available to the public, while maybe 90% is automatically funneled to ticket agencies, to ticket scalpers. All right. And so Ticketmaster gets a cut. You'll go online and try to get tickets and you'll be told, Ticketmaster, you know, this is sold out, but we are directing you over to our sister site, air quotes, which are scalpers, and those, and you are no longer going to have a shot at paying face value. So this is automatically before the public even gets the sale.
And, you know, the other thing that frustrates me, and I agree, right? You know, all the fees that Ticketmaster throws on top, right?
Right.
Now, That is not just Ticketmaster. I don't know the last time you had to go buy a tire for your car, but they tell you, we've got one for $50. Okay, great. And you end up, the invoice is $89.
Yeah.
Like what? Well, we've got a $10 for the valve. We've got a tire and balance. We've got an excise tax. We've got a disposal fee. And I'm like, holy crap. Could you just tell me? Yeah, the tire is going to be $85 all in. But they don't do that.
Yeah. So let's consider the good old days.
Yeah.
When Bruce actually did do something. And because, I mean, look, the one person that has done anything, and again, it's a little bit, but at least somebody spoke out this week, and what Robert Smith did.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, even before COVID, before the shutdowns, I was suggesting a touring freeze for everybody. Just stop, you know, because Ticketmaster's got to come down to earth at some point. So, Bruce, let's consider that Bruce is now 73 years old. Okay. He's going to be 74 this year, I believe. Right. So he can't do what he used to do in terms of the first leg of the tour is going to have 10 nights per venue, but this is the first leg of the tour. And what a lot of fans are not considering, what they should know by now in terms of the amount of shows he's playing. Well, he's only playing one night per city. Right. True. Oh, he's playing a structured set list. He's playing the same song every night. True. But if we know anything about the history of Bruce's tours, number one, Bruce usually sticks to a structured set list, especially in the early parts of a tour. Okay, you could say that about Born in the USA, give or take a few songs a night. All right.
Rising was the same.
The Rising, Tunnel of Love.
And then this River, he told
the reunion tour was structured.
Yes.
Right.
So I think they're thinking of like Working on the Dream and Magic, where they started playing things around.
And later in the tour, on the last leg of the tours is when Bruce starts to get adventurous, where it becomes the free for alls that we loved over the past 15 years.
Right.
And who's to say that this isn't going to happen in August and September?
I would bet money it would. And I think also that right now, this is a story he wants to tell.
Absolutely.
I'm totally on board with it. Yeah. If you follow the set list, you know, and in the story he is telling, he is talking about mortality. He is talking about beginnings and endings, and he is wanting to tell that story. I also think it's good to remember, and I've said this a lot, Mike, is one of the most important things, if you are in the comic book industry, a mantra is every comic book is someone's first comic book.
Right.
So when you're writing, you have to assume they know nothing.
This is their first show.
This is their first Springsteen show. They want to hear Rosalita. They want to hear Born to Run. They want to hear Glory Days. They want to hear Dancing in the Dark. For the longest time, he very seldom did Dancing in the Dark and Glory Days each day. If you have gone to 50 shows and you're tired of hearing Rosalita, I get it. But you got to get yourself out of your and go, yes, if I had unlimited money and I could go to Bruce and say, hey, $5 million to your favorite charity, here's the set list I want you and the band to do, I would probably be an audience of one being happy, right? Because I have things that people don't want to hear. I was very vocal. I'm not a Kitty's Back fan. But when I saw it live in Dallas, that night when I got home, I did a quick video to talk about the show. And I said, I apologize to Kitty's Back.
Yeah, I remember that.
Everything that I said, this song kicked ass.
Yeah.
Right. So you never know And so I just sometimes think we fans get overly complacent and overly selfish
And spoiled.
and spoiled.
Spoiled is the
Perfect word.
word. We're
Yes.
spoiled, man. And that's
Right.
what you gotta take that into consideration
Right.
and have some sort of a balanced approach to it. I just sit back and watch the theatrics. I don't get involved. I'm
Yes.
kind of, but I think Steve said it best. You know, Steve said something to the effect that, you know, something like the set list is designed more or less to tell the story of the band,
Right.
highlighting its various eras through key songs that best reflect those eras. And
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much what he's doing, very much like the Broadway show.
Yeah, and I was in Houston, and with Linda, I was with our friends, and he says, "I wrote this song 50 years ago, and I still don't know what the F it's about." And we look and we go, no. And he goes into If I Was the Priest.
Did you see? You saw the first time he did it.
Yes.
See, that was a
And
big show, man.
that, and you're like, okay, how can you complain? Right? Like, this is, and so I just feel, I also, this is so morbid, and so I shouldn't have to say this, but I'm going to. What would a guy play to see Prince again? What would people say to hear John Lennon again? What would the fan who's never seen Michael Jackson perform pay to see Michael perform again? And go on and on and on. Would I love to see Harry Ch I saw Harry Chapin once, and it wasn't with a band. God, Linda Ronstadt has now lost her voice. She's still with us, but she can't perform again. What would you give to get one more song with that wonderful, that queen of pop? We
She's a
just
national treasure, man.
exactly. We just
You
lost
know?
Loretta Lynn. We just, it just, and instead of the other thing as well, God, he's only, hitting 3 hours. No, he's 73 doing 2 hours and 45 minutes. And oh, by the way, if he added a minute between songs, which he doesn't, it would be over 3 hours. My son, the first show he went to was in 2016, and we're driving home. It was in Oklahoma City, and we were driving home the next day, and he's like, "Bruce doesn't play, does he?" The one song's ending and they're starting immediately. They're like, you got to know what the hell you're doing or else you're going to be lost, because Bruce don't play. And I that's true. It's just compact.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Have you gotten to see the show yet? Have you gotten to
Not
see the
yet.
show?
I usually, and this is not, maybe the prices have something
I
to do with
mean,
it, but
it's not
I
cheap.
generally skip the first leg.
Okay.
Just kind of historically,
Okay.
except I mean, with the exception of the reunion tour,
Yeah.
and I don't know if I've seen a first leg since the reunion tour.
Okay.
I usually go back later, like that whenever he comes back, I give it a chance to things to simmer a little bit. You know, if he goes into the stadiums, you know, it's just not like where, you know, he used to beat the scalpers by going in the major, where the major cities, where the big scalping problems were, you know, and he'd play 6 nights, 6, 7 nights in LA, 7 nights in Philly, 10
Right.
nights in Jersey, you know, 2 nights in, you know, the other places around. I mean, he was never playing less than 2 nights anywhere he went,
Yeah.
you know, for a few decades there. But I want to talk to you about the shows that you've been to. You know, I wrote the book on him, but you know, it's like I wrote a book on him. But after you write a book, you kind of you release it, you go on to the next project.
Yeah.
You've spent far more hours in conversations about Bruce Springsteen than I have.
Yeah.
You're in constant touch with the community. I trust your interactions with the fan community to be a fair and accurate gauge of this tour, as well as the climate both inside and outside of the shows. You've been to a few shows already. So, I mean, in general, just what is your takeaway so far from like everything that you've seen firsthand on any level that you might want to share, whether it be the tickets, whether it be Bruce's, the theme of the show, or where Bruce seems to be mentally during these shows, or what his intentions are, just the overall, what's your takeaway? If you can sum it up at this point in the tour.
So I think the majority of the fans I've talked to, that I think most of them have enjoyed the show, nitpicks here and there, but they have an awareness of, okay, I may not want to hear Johnny 99, but I can understand stuff someone else does, right? That we are all going to have little bitty things. So I think most people are very happy that they're back on. I think that this minority of people complaining are helping to drive a journalist agenda of, oh my goodness, Bruce has lost his, you know, lost the common man, and you know that you have to be rich to see a show, and I just don't think that's a fair narrative, but that's the narrative that's being told. But overall, I think everyone has been happy. I've had people, you know, I have a voicemail, and I have people call me afterwards and leave a 2-3 minute review. Everyone seems to be happy. And so I think there is a lot of excitement that once it hits Europe, we may get some things changing. I do also feel, and Mike, I think you know this from your, you know, work, is you build up you get on a roll, and because of COVID, Bruce has been like a baseball manager not knowing his starting lineup. Right. So he keeps having to change. Oh, don't have Niels tonight. Okay. Well, I don't have Curtis King, so I can't do this. So I wonder how much they're getting to roll and build in that. So yeah, I think overall, there's a lot of excitement. There are people, like, I didn't particularly care for the Seeger sessions, but that's a personal thing because he didn't sing Froggy Went to Court in the way my dad did. So therefore Bruce is wrong.
Or the way we did in kindergarten, because that was one of our music class songs.
Yes, fact, thank you, Mike.
In elementary school, in music class, we sang Erie Canal, Pay Me My Money Down, and at the time it was called Mr. Frog Went to Court.
Yes, and he doesn't sing them the way that I sang in kindergarten or the way my dad sang them. You know, there are people that don't care for the covers album. I said it was fun. I thought, you know, and at this point, if he wants to do it, he's do it. I mean, I think Western Stars and Letter to You is as good a late career duo that anyone has done.
But I then love I'm Western biased. Stars.
I do too.
I love it.
And would I want him to do some live? Absolutely. I mean, I would love him to do, you know, whether it's Tucson Train or Western Stars or Stones or, you know, Hello Sunshine, any of them, I would love. So yeah, I think overall we're good. I still have plenty of people wanting to join me on the podcast, and they seem to have a good time and they love talking about Bruce. And the other thing that I think is really important, Mike, is that I love baseball, but there is a fear that the new generation of sports fans have no interest in that sport. It appears, and I have had people on the podcast that are 18, 19, 20 that are big Springsteen fans that are excited that this is their first tour. So I think Springsteen fandom is in good shape.
Oh, yeah. There's no question about that. I just lost my, I lost what I was going to say. Let me get this. I'll have to edit this part out.
No problem.
Don't you love when things are going so smooth and you're like, I don't have to do much editing. And then,
yes,
but I just like a total brain fart here, but it was something pretty significant. Oh, you know what it was? Okay. So I just lost it again. Oh my God. I got to get some sleep.
Yes.
Okay. So I think that you mentioned when once he goes over to Europe, I think the older these guys get, and this goes for any artist that's over 70 right now that are out there, you're taking on a massive tour. You're going all over the world. You've got 100+ dates booked around the world. People are counting on you. There's a lot of money at stake. Promoters, fans, vendors, you know, the venues themselves, right? There's a lot at stake. Health is always an issue. Age is an issue. COVID is an issue. So going out there, they're just at the outset, there has to be a certain amount of stress, pressure, and a general sense of, even if they're not talking about it, but in the back of your mind, what if I get sick? What if somebody gets sick? What if something happens? What if this? What if, what if, what if? 10 days into the tour, 15 days of the tour, right? I'm watching this. You're watching this. We're all watching this tour like we're watching baseball standings. Like, you know, yes. You know what I mean? Like, who won the game last night? Read the box score. We're reading the set list. We're seeing what happened, right? Yeah. Did they make it through last night, right?
They are.
I'm rooting for them more than I ever have. I'm not seeing any shows on this leg of the tour, but I'm watching it. I'm watching it on the edge of my seat because there's always that feeling, that morbid thing that's just kind of hovering over every artist that's out there right now.
Yes.
And so as they get deeper and deeper into the tour, the first leg ends, they go to Europe, they come back, it's summertime, late summer. I think at that point, where the, you know, that first go round where everybody gets to see him at least once, like he's covered every city at least once, I think the pressure kind of comes off him. You know, now everybody's seen that initial presentation, the 2023 presentation, what we're presenting as the E Street Band in 2023 on this tour, we've done it. We've done it once. Now we're going to go back. We're going to clean up maybe the secondary markets or the smaller markets. And then we're going to go out and do the stadiums. The signs are going to come out.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, as you said, like maybe after Europe, I think there's just a general, maybe unspoken pressure on these dates that we're seeing in real time as they're happening. And a lot hinging on it. And I think that that's in the back of everybody's mind. I know it's on mine. I know it's got to be on yours as you're watching the set list every night. And then in the morning that follows. And some of us are watching it as it happens on setlists.com, you know, in real time. So it's like it's like some fan said to him at the book signing in 2017. It means more with every year.
It really does. And well said, Mike. I mean, I just think that it's important to not lose your perspective, to remember that, you know, we're lucky that we still got them, and let's enjoy this and let's really embrace the fact that, you know, we're seeing arguably one of the best rock and roll bands, and are they in their prime? No, but they're still pretty damn good, right?
Bruce and the E Street Band on their worst night will blow away any band out there on their best night. I'll go to my grave believing that.
Oh, I'm right there with you.
And I've seen. I haven't seen everybody, but I've seen almost everybody.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah.
Good.
But I want to, you know, like I said, I don't want to keep you long. I want to wrap up shortly, but I want to go, I want to echo some of the questions that you gave me.
Okay.
Talk about some of the stuff we covered in your podcast. And these are just random. Okay, these aren't random. I know what I want to ask you, but these are just fun questions. Some of them are a little bit, you know, like I have this game called Gun to the Head that we play on the podcast. I'm not a fan of guns, but that's the name of it, is if somebody put a gun to your head, say, quick, this or that, right?
Okay.
But I do you distinguish between best and favorites? We talk
You know, I tend to think of favorites, right? Like, there is, I don't agree with this sticker, but I had to order it. Someone sent me a sticker and I ordered it. It said, Tunnel of Love is better than Born to Run. And I'm tired of, you know, defending that position. I don't agree with that, but I do agree that if I had to choose between Tunnel of Love and Darkness on the Edge of Town, I would pick Tunnel of Love every day. I like Tunnel of Love songs better than I do Darkness on the Edge of Town songs. That is heresy. I'm not saying it's better, but I'm saying my favorite, right? I am not a Jungleland fan. To me, Trapped is just another cover song. I mean, like the guys.
Yeah, we talked about this last week, I think.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah, we
that
did.
Was you.
Yeah, it was. You know, and I'm like, and people are like, no, Trapped is one of the greatest songs ever. I'm like, okay, I'm glad you think so, but not to me, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I remember because you asked me, well, what did I think was his best? This question comes out of my conversation with you last year. You did ask me what I thought his best album was. And I said, well, I always have to distinguish between best and favorites before I answer that, because what I think is his best album being objective.
Right.
What I objectively think is his best album is not necessarily what my favorite album is. And like I said, my favorite album of his, if I really have to be honest with myself, would be The River. And I said to you, I don't think that by any means is his best album, because I think his best album would have to go to Darkness.
Right.
So that question just stemmed from my conversation with you. So Tunnel? Would yours favorite be Tunnel?
Boy, it would be close. If I Don't Have You is not the great, so I don't like that song necessarily, but there is something really beautiful about Tunnel of Love. I love Wrecking Ball, would leave Belly of a Whale off of it. But Wrecking Ball is a really, really great album for me. And you know, I really love Western Stars and Letter to You. And Letter to You has the distinction of, we were in the middle of a pandemic. We were slowly coming out of it. And we had spent 4 years under, not to get political, but an administration I don't agree with. And for that fall to get a new Springsteen album and a new president is hard for that emotionally for me not to have a sentimental place in Letter to You.
You can get as political as you want on this podcast, because I mean, Rock Under Fire, I named my podcast out of the war that the conservative right wing has had on rock and roll since the day Elvis Presley set foot on the Ed Sullivan show, man. But anyway, you just said something that having so many brain farts tonight.
That's okay. I'm loving our discussion. We should do this on a regular basis. Like every couple of months, we should just meet and just bullshit.
Yeah, this
hit record and then just post it, right?
Oh man, but it was such a good thought. And I was like, I mentioned on your show that I wasn't that big of a fan of the Letter to You album. And I loved Western Stars much more. That was part of our conversation. Yeah. And I think it was you said the opposite. I think you said, like, at the time you liked Letter to You more than Western Stars. But something that I thought was really, really cool on a personal note.
Yeah.
My book, Autumn and Everything After, the book about Bruce and John Lennon, came out the same exact week as Letter to You. Now, A good portion of the book takes place inside the Dakota apartment building.
Yeah.
Bruce is photographed outside the Dakota on the cover. So I don't know if anybody knows how many people know that, but the cover of Letter to You, and I looked at that cover when the first time I saw it, and he's in the snow and he's see the buildings behind him. I'm like, that sure looks familiar.
I did not know that. That outside is amazing.
He's standing outside at the entrance to Strawberry Fields in Central Park, and you have Central Park West behind him, and on the right side you see the Dakota.
Yeah.
And 72nd Street. And I said, wow, that is totally cosmic. Because I remember I got a little bit, not pissed off, but when I found out that Bruce was releasing an album the same month that I was releasing my book, I was like, typical. That's just so typical. Look, he's going to upstage me now. I was like, we're up to date. I was like, no, this book is up to date. Because at the end of the book, I'm talking in real time, in present tense. Bruce Springsteen is currently doing a radio show, and this was during the, you know, and now he's going to add this brand new album to make my book out of date. So
that's awesome. Okay, I love that.
Favorite song?
Better Days and Land of Hope and Dreams are my two favorite Springsteen songs. If I had to push album, I'd probably pick Pet Sounds over any Springsteen album because I adore Pet Sounds.
Okay, that's an interesting one. Yeah, favorite album overall. Favorite non-Bruce album.
Yeah, Pet Sounds. Yeah, I love Pet Sounds.
I'm going to go with The Wall from Pink Floyd.
Oh, that's a good pick.
That's one of I adore that record. It's a really dark, dreary album, but I mean, it's a childhood album that goes by. I mean, you know, I was 10 years old when it came out, but I would say, I mean, like, favorite song is just like, oh, man. Do you have a favorite performance? Like, if you got into, like, live versions of Bruce, do you have any particular favorite performance?
So a couple of them. Know? One is I love the 10th Avenue Freeze Out that's on the live in New York, right? Where he, you know, that lasts like 20 minutes. There is one of my favorites. I grew up in Louisiana on and off. The college I went to, its fight song was Jolie Blanc. And Bruce's version of Jolie Blanc, there's one, and I think it's Melbourne. I'd have to look, but there is one where it was a sign request. And he said, oh, good call, very obscure. And the banded him do Jolie Blanc. And the idea, I mean, they get Charlie comes with an accordion and Susie's with the fiddle. And that's one of my favorite music. Another great cover that I think is a great moment, I would have loved to have been there, was when the guy had a letter saying, it's Mother's Day and my mom is my hero. Can you do a song for her? And can she dance with you? And Bruce picks Say the Last Dance for Me. And they do that. That's on video. And that's a great moment.
And that may have been the one time he did that. Right?
Yeah,
In the last 10 years, right? Was that something like on the Magic Tour or the work?
Yeah,
that time bracket. Yeah. I remember watching that on YouTube. A story about Jolie Blanc. I was doing it was obscure, and he hadn't done it since the River Tour. It was the only time he had done it on the summer leg of the River Tour, and on the 90 the other band, quote unquote, you know, he came back at the end of Europe 93 and he did two shows, and he just cut the tour short. We were supposed to come back and do another US leg, but he didn't. And he ended it with these two benefit shows, one at the Garden and one at the Meadowlands. And at the Garden, he had Terrence Trent D'Arby as a guest.
Yeah.
And he came out and they did that song. And I was like, oh my God, man, this is like totally obscure. That was like that. You could not have called that by any, like, no, that was that song wasn't happening. If I had to pick, like, my favorite performance, I think, is 1975 CW Post For You, the piano version of For You, which is very similar to the one he released on the London Hammersmith.
Okay.
All right, favorite outtake. Now, favorite outtake, we know everything's been given to us at this point. You know, during those days where it wasn't released, you know, something that didn't make an original album.
Ain't Good Enough from you, from the from the Promise, you know, that box set.
Sure, sure, yeah.
I love that song. I think it would be a great pop hit. It's got the line about Jimmy Iovine. And also, I feel like playing that every time I hear a selfish Springsteen fan, oh man, I can't believe, you know, like it ain't good enough for you, right? You know, yeah, that's it. I'd love to hear Daniel's The Lion's Den. I'd love to hear, I never thought I'd see The Wish. So when I got to go to Broadway, that was a one checked off my list. But yeah, that would be it.
Yeah, The Wish I've never seen. From the concerts you've been to, your favorite moment at a concert could be a song. You know, maybe Bruce took your request sign. Maybe he took a selfie with you.
So
your most memorable, best moment.
Probably a couple. I was in Houston. And two things happened that show. The Flores brothers, who were I got on the podcast, had a sign. I busted my brother out of school. Can we sing No Surrender with you? And these two guys came up and knew every word. They sang all the time. And then when it's time for them to leave stage, like, they shook every member of the band's hand and like was doing it. That's great. And then the other, there was a sign request for One Step Up. And Bruce was, he said, "You have made your bed, sir. We do not know this song." And so that was a really special moment. Then of course, getting If I Was the Priest is right up there too. But before those would have been my top choices.
You witnessed my Holy Grail moment, man. You got if the first performance of that song.
Yeah, it was amazing. I won't lie. And, you know, there were two or three people in this, you know, kind of secluded area where our suite was. And we were like, I can't believe he's playing this. So it was amazing.
It's got to be so surreal. I mean, it's like I've been listening to that bootleg since I was 19, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
the piano version, that deep, you know, thick piano. And oh man. Have you gotten in your concert history with Bruce, have you gotten those set lusting Holy Grail songs that you've been chasing? And if not yet, what are they?
So I really would love Better Days, which I've never gotten. Jolie Blanc, which I've never had gotten. I only got Girls in Their Summer Clothes once, and I would really love that again. So those are probably my top three. I would love Highway Patrolman. I think that's one of my favorite songs from Nebraska. And I think I would be really happy to hear it. So those are the top four, I think.
Nice. Nice. Your dream set list. If you could construct the greatest possible Springsteen concert in your eyes, that concert begins with what song?
I actually did this earlier, either late last year. So I don't remember what I picked then. I think Meet Me in the City is a really good opening song. I really love that on the River Tour.
That was fun.
Yeah, that was really fun. I would probably pick Better Days. You know, I would start that. Meet Me in the City would be a really good one to have. I just think that was, I wish that song stayed in the rotation because I just think it's a really good opener.
I wish I got to see that song because I didn't see that 2016 tour until the last leg. So I was
when he changed it, right?
Crazy, crazy set list that went on for like four hours. I was at those shows.
Right.
And he was no longer doing the whole album. But yeah. I loved that song when it came out, and I loved it as an opener.
Absolutely.
Yeah, my thing, my opener would be that classic opening of Night. You know, it's just so. And your dream set list ends with what song?
Land of Hope and Dreams.
Yeah.
If I had my choice, he'd end every show with Land of Hope and Dreams. I'll See You in My Dreams right now, solo, is pretty damn good. And so I'd say Land of Hope and Dreams, and then everyone leaves, and then he does I'll See You in My Dreams last. But Land of Hope and Dreams, I mean, those are my two favorite songs. So if he could start with Better Days and with Land of Hope and Dreams, no matter what else is in the middle, I'm going to be thrilled.
Yeah, that's very, very similar. My favorite ending was Follow That Dream.
Oh, that would be great.
In 93, I saw a show where he closed with that, and he had the girls out behind him, and it was just like this gospel background, and just as far as like this summation of the whole message, the whole experience. On your podcast, really quick, do you have any particularly memorable guests that stick out that you say, yeah, man, that one was great?
So a couple. David Leaf last year was with me, and he has written the Brian Wilson and the California Myth, the original, I think the best Brian Wilson biography of all time. He was on the show, and we did two episodes. We did one talking about Brian and then one talking about his Springsteen fandom. Coming up for my 1,000th episode is Peter Ames Carland is joined me, the writer of Bruce. And that was a really, really good episode. Recently, I had, which was totally not planned, but someone suggested it. I reached out, but Chuck Morgan is the voice of the Globe Life Stadium, the Texas Rangers, where they play baseball. And he has spent over 30 years doing stadium. But before that, he worked at the Grand Ole Opry. And he told so many great stories about ball players and music and everything. And he was a really good interview.
Do you have your 1,000th episode in the can already?
I do.
All right. You're already working beyond that now.
Yeah. I have, like I said, I have Peter ready. I've got some others coming up. I have one coming up next week as we record this. I recently found the Story Song podcast. It's part of the Pantheon network. And it is three friends basically taking story songs like, me and Bobby McGee or, Maggie May. And they break apart all the lyrics and just go to extremes, just how silly they are. And I had Dan, who's one of the co-hosts of that, join me. And that's coming up next week. And that was a lot of fun.
Nice. Jesse, keep doing what you're doing, man.
Thank you, my friend. I really appreciate it.
If there's one thing about Bruce fans, they love to talk Bruce. And you might have the best platform out there for the fans. Thanks for taking the time to do this. Again, I know you're usually in the driver's seat, so I hope I was able to give you a little bit of a break between your episodes.
It was
congratulations on 1,000 episodes.
Yes.
Do you have any websites where people can find you or your work or anything that you want to plug?
Sure. So go to Set Listening. I'm at Jesse Jackson DFW on Twitter. You can email me setlustingbruce@gmail.com. And just follow me. If you want to be part of the podcast, email me. I'll get you on. I just really appreciate the time. It was fun visiting with you. Little side note, I was supposed to do another podcast at 9 my time. So I've emailed the guy,
oh,
like,
shit,
I'm running a little bit late. Hang tight.
Oh shit, you should have said something.
No,
man.
I was having too much fun, my friend. I was having too much fun.
Should I cut that part out or should I just let it go?
No, let it go. You can
All
say,
right.
yeah,
I don't
that's
know how
how
much
we're
I'm gonna edit, man. I think I'm just gonna leave my brain farts in too.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks again, Jesse. We'll
let's do
talk
this
again.
in.
And yeah, man, I'll meet you further on up the road.
Sounds good, brother. See you
Peace.
soon. Bye-bye.
Take care.